From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Another asteroid is headed toward Earth. It's been named 2002-NT7. It's expected to buzz the planet in a mere 17 years on February 1st, 2019. Astronomers are already calculating the odds, telling the public not to worry. The likelihood of a collision, they say, is tiny. Centuries ago, the threat of an oncoming asteroid or even a passing comet was the harbinger of Armageddon, not just a blip on the astronomers' radar screens. Like our ancestors, we're still contemplating our place in the universe and predicting when and how it might all come to an end. Today, our celestial imaginings are based more on scientific inquiry than religious fervor. We have Einstein's theory of relativity, inflationary theory, and the Big Bang. But the ultimate questions and answers remain as vast and fiery as any in ancient scripture. How do you make sense of the cosmos? With science or religion? And what do you want science to tell you about the beginning and end of everything we know? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from West Lebanon, New Hampshire, is Marcelo Gleiser. He's author of The Prophet and the Astronomer, A Scientific Journey to the End of Time, and professor of philosophy, physics, and astronomy at Dartmouth College. Good evening and welcome, Professor Gleiser.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
I've dipped into your book, and I'm starstruck. I hardly know where to begin here. I love the brave way in which you've taken up both the efforts of religion and science to come to understand the cosmos. And I guess the starting place is to ask, why have so many world religions, and scientists ultimately, looked to the heavens to make sense of the world we live in? Why look up?
Well, starting with the religious part, if you go back, say, 10, 15,000 years, you know, way before there was anything like science around, people were very much dependent on the skies. And they were dependent on the skies because they were regular. You know, there were certain cycles mm-hmm. that repeated themselves, like every day repeats every 24 hours, every year, every 365 days, the four seasons. And this regularity of the skies basically helped people organize their lives and actually helped them survive, you know, in a sometimes hostile nature. So they knew when to plant, they knew when to harvest, they knew when the floods were, and things like that. So the skies were very much taken to be supernatural. They were the realms of the gods, and the gods were usually good. And so that's the origin of the awe that we had with the skies. We knew that we depended on them for survival. You know, the rains came from the skies, the sun and the heat from the sun came from the skies. And in fact, lots of religions were sun-worshipping religions, like the Egyptians and the Incas and many, many others, and the Japanese, the Shintos. Mm-hmm. And so that's really where this awe begins.
And now that we're well into the age of science, we still look to the skies and far beyond the sky to explain the ultimate meaning of things. I guess that's just essentially an acknowledgement that we're a very tiny speck in a very large space.
Yes, it's a funny thing that perhaps the most fundamental question that we can ask as humans is, where do we come from? You know, what are our origins? Mm-hmm. And so the question of beginnings is a very, very deep question that has been with us since history began. So every culture you can think of has been asking the same question, you know, where do we come from? And many of the answers were originally, of course, religious answers. You know, they were questions that were asked. And depending where you were, there are different myths of creation, you know, myths that explain how things came to be from nothing, apparently. And a lot of them said, you know, the gods made it, and there are many, many, many different versions of it that I actually explained in the first book I wrote called The Dancing Universe. And in science, at least in this part of science, which is called cosmology, we are, in a sense, heirs to this very, very ancient tradition. We are asking essentially the same questions. We're just using very different tools in order to make sense of the universe around us. And as you said, you know, the more we learn about things, the more insignificant we become. So if I would tell you a little history of cosmological thought, you know, it starts with the Earth in the center. You know, the Greeks and people before the Greeks, the mm-hmm. Babylonians, etc., mm-hmm. said, you know, the Earth was the center, and we are right in the middle of it. So here we are.
We remember well. We all had it in our grade school textbooks, the old drawings.
Exactly. And then, you know, you move on to the Renaissance and the 15th and the 16th century especially, and the Earth is removed from the center, and then comes the Sun. So now the Sun is the center, and we say, well, okay, at least our Sun, you know, it's our star, so we're still very close to the center. And then in the 20th century, what we found out is that the Sun is just one star amongst billions, hundreds of billions, actually, of other stars in the galaxy called the Milky Way, which is basically our home galaxy. And even this galaxy, which until 1924 was thought to be the only galaxy in the universe, is now known to be just one amongst hundreds of billions of others. So
our understanding has galloped ahead. Let me ask you this. We often see science and religion in opposition, and especially when it comes to these ultimate questions of beginnings and ends. Yet in your book, I feel a kind of openness to not seeing these two in opposition. How do you see science and religion relating to one another when it comes to understanding the universe? Are they mutually exclusive? Are they in opposition or not?
I'm really glad you asked that, because you're right. Unfortunately, science and religion are usually noted as being in opposite camps, right? And in fact, pretty much antagonistic towards each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do, you know, being a research scientist that likes to publicize science, what I found is that by looking at the history of science, you absolutely cannot forget its religious roots. So science.
You say religious roots, but we think of Galileo in chains and Copernicus on the run. We somehow think of religion not as the roots of science, but as the you know, antithesis of science.
Right, and that's where the conflict, which is mistaken, starts, because people think of these images, you know, and think that that's the story, but in fact that's not the story. And if you start to understand the story better, you realize that they are very much sisters of the same family, in the sense that, for example, since you mentioned Galileo, let's talk a little bit about him.
Mm-hmm.
So Galileo was a deeply religious person. In fact, his daughter was a nun. And what Galileo was trying to do was he was trying to save the church from embarrassment. Because, you know, through his astronomical observations, you know, 1609, 1610, the telescope, he found that there was a lot of circumstantial evidence. It wasn't like the smoking gun. It was circumstantial evidence that indeed the sun must be the center, which is what Copernicus said about 60 years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the church, you know, look, the theologians are interpreting the Bible by saying that, it is the earth because it's written this way. We must have to reinterpret the Bible. You're just reinterpreting it wrong. The Bible must be right, but the theologians are humans and they can make mistakes.
And the church whacked him down. We know that story. But does the fact that Galileo was motivated, as you describe other famous scientists, Isaac Newton and others, does the fact that he was motivated out of a sense of wanting to protect and defend his faith mean that he wasn't a man of science? Wasn't he essentially scientific in his approach to understanding the universe? And is that still not somehow in opposition to a religious approach?
Right. He was very much a man of science. And the point is this, is that, you know, these subjective reasons why somebody becomes a scientist, they vary a lot. And I always say, you know, you go to a bank, you're going to find all sorts of people in a bank. You go to a department of physics and astronomy, you're going to find all sorts of people, including those, some of them who are orthodox in their religion. So you are going to find orthodox Jews or very Christian people in different departments, and that is completely not in conflict with their research. And the way they justify that is they say, look, you know, I'm doing these things because I believe that they are the work of God, and in understanding his work or her work, depending on your inclination, I am actually getting closer to him. And hence, my science justifies my religion.
Let me ask you this. With all that we've learned in a century where our understanding has grown so rapidly, do we find ourselves now with the scientific understanding of the universe, the cosmos, more or less in agreement with earlier religious understandings?
I think that it's really dangerous to put things this way, because if you say we are more in agreement, we are actually saying that science is basically rediscovering religion.
Well, I don't mean that. I guess even I'm imagining we look at religion in its most metaphorical sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are certain ways of thinking about nature which are very much part of the way we function, you know, as humans. And a scientist or a religious person just cannot escape that.
Such as?
For example, when we think about the creation of the world, mm-hmm. you really can make, you can play this game as basically a logical game. And you can do it, and this is something I did in my first book, you can do it this way. You can say, was there a beginning of time? Yes or no, right? And then if there mm-hmm. is a beginning of time, some time ago, obviously, mm-hmm. How could that be? There are three proposed answers, and this is by looking at hundreds of different creation myths, mm-hmm. you know, from all sorts of cultures. One of them says there was a supernatural being, a god or a goddess, or a god and a goddess sure. that created the world. Mm-hmm. This is the Jewish Christian tradition falls into this. Mm-hmm. The other one is to say, and this happened sometime in the past, mm-hmm. the other one is to say that there was order and chaos in the beginning, and there was a lot of strife between the two, and suddenly, without some divine intervention, order prevails. You know, it sort of emerges spontaneously out of this chaotic initial soup.
A kind of Hindu version, maybe.
This is, yeah, it's also something that appears in Chinese myths, mm-hmm. Taoist myths. And finally, you know, in this category, you can also have the world coming out of nothing. So the Maori Indians of New Zealand, for example, would say that, you know, in the beginning there was nothing, there were no gods, there was just nothing. And out of this nothing, the only thing that existed was the urge to become. And out of this urge, there comes the universe.
So, there you have those three fundamentals. Are there parallels to these approaches in science?
Yes. But these are mm-hmm. the guys that basically believe there was a moment in the past when the universe
okay.
came to be. There's another alternative, which is no to the answer, which have two choices. One is a cyclic universe, which is created and destroyed continuously and rhythmically throughout time. Mm-hmm. And that is the Hindu myth of the dance of Shiva, you
okay.
know, that creates
mm-hmm.
and destroys. And then you have another one, which says that the universe was never created or destroyed, it just is. You know, it doesn't have a beginning mm-hmm. of time or mm-hmm. an end of time, which is also from India. So each one of these categories with proper translations fits into models of cosmology that were proposed in the 20th century.
You mean that there are scientific models that might be a rough approximation, but in scientific terms of each of these?
Yes. And this is really interesting. So, for example,
we wanted science to settle the question.
Yeah, well, that's the difference. That's exactly very good. That's exactly the point, which is the fact that those models were all proposed before there was enough data mm-hmm. in order to discern between them. And once the data came, one model won.
And that is?
The Big Bang model,
mm-hmm.
you know, which says that, you know, the universe had a very dense and hot childhood, let's put it that way, about 14 billion years ago. And we know that with tremendous certainty nowadays because of a huge amount of data that was produced in the last 20 years or so.
So which does this match up with? Is this the from nothing, suddenly it emerged?
Well, you could say that, yes. That it would be a nothing, but then this nothing has to be qualified as a physics nothing, not an absolute nothing, because in physics there is no such thing as complete emptiness. There is always something out there.
Before we get to that, though, does that mean then that the religious antecedent was important or not? Was it just a myth that happened to match up with what we found scientifically?
It was exactly the latter. I mean, it was just a myth that happened to match up with what we found scientifically, because nobody really that were thinking about these questions knew, I'm sure, about mm-hmm. the Maori Indians of New Zealand and their creation myths. But that's why I mentioned in the beginning that there are just a few certain ways in which we can think about certain questions, and that's an example of it. So mm-hmm. it's a logical game. There are only so many answers you can give to this question of creation.
It's inevitable then that science and religion would match up at certain points in their guesses, in what they know. Marcelo Gleiser, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about reading the cosmos tonight, about understanding the beginning and the end of the universe, thinking in religious and scientific terms. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Do you want a scientific explanation for how it all began? Or not? Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're reading the cosmos tonight with author and professor Marcelo Gleiser. He's just written The Prophet and the Astronomer, A Scientific Journey to the End of Time. We're talking about the beginning and the end of the universe tonight, and about the dance of science and religion that have helped humankind for a long time try to make sense of what it all means. You can join our conversation as well. Does science replace religion in illuminating the cosmos? Do you want to know how and when, scientifically, the world will end? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Very interesting discussion. But I'm also a working scientist. I'm a membrane biophysicist, and we apply physical principles to the study of biological systems and biological molecules. And I guess I had a number of points I wanted to make. First of all, I do think that religion and science are fundamentally antithetical. And I'm always distressed when the wonders of science are used to sort of rehabilitate a crumbling religious view of the world. And I say that for several reasons. First of all, I think your guest kind of gave it away when he talked about the religious motivation of some scientists. And he says, in referring to their God, he referred to him. And it could be her. But I think sort of at one level, religious explanations are above and beyond all else boring. It always comes down to the guy in the sky, or the gal in the sky.
And yet, John, they've been awfully captivating to an awful lot of people for a long time. It may be unfair to describe Marcelo Gleiser as using science to prop up religion, but can you see the resonance between the two, especially when it comes to cosmology?
Let me finish. So in one sense, all the mystery and wonder of science are just defeated by this kind of pale and pathetic view of the universe that's run by a guy in the sky. That's one thing. The other thing is that science, religion, certainly tried its best in one epoch to ask fundamental questions, but it could never answer any of them. It never allowed us to navigate or to fly or to reach the moon. It was powerless, really. Although, and Galileo and others, who found it difficult, I think, to leave their religious roots, they found a new method, a method that was not faith, but data. Data and reasoning versus faith.
John, hold it there. I want Marcelo Gleiser to respond to the thrust of your questions. Marcelo, Professor Gleiser, John is saying he's a scientist, and religion looks pale and pathetic to him, and improved relatively powerless.
Right. So I would agree with him completely in the sense that, indeed, you know, you should not ever use religion to kind of try to explain the goings of the universe. You know, that's exactly what science does. And if you read my books, you realize that I'm very much in that side of the camp. So what I do try to do is that I realize that there is a lot of strife between religion and science, especially amongst people who are more religious. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to approach them in a way that they will respect scientists and not despise them. So,
What's your method in that approach?
Well, first of all, I respect, you know, the past. I respect the tradition that led lots of scientists to think about nature, which was essentially a religious tradition, you know. And you're talking here about Newton, and you're also talking about people like Einstein, for example, who was, in his own way, a very religious person, and he himself writes about that. So what I try, the way I think that there is a point in common is in the questions we're asking, not in the way we answer them. You know, so people are just fascinated by these questions, and it's true. Towards, you know, the 18th century and 19th century, with the growing secularization of society, you know, science became the way to look at those things, and God was, in a sense, squeezed out of the picture, pretty much.
John, I want to bring you back. It sounds as though Professor Gleiser is saying acknowledging the similarity of questions is almost a way to open a conversation between religions and science here.
Well, yes and no. And again, the roots, I agree with, that people tried in antiquity to find the answers with the kind of poetic tools they had at hand, but it didn't work. And I guess the other thing is we could talk about Einstein, but his belief in a God was not a guy in the sky. It was some fundamental, almost pantheistic force.
Right.
And I guess there's another dimension to this. I think it disturbs me a little bit is because with the coming of the scientific view, there was a great impact on society. The Enlightenment came out of that. Our democracy was born of that.
Mm-hmm.
The liberation of human beings who had no property or who were women or who were of color.
Do you think we're backsliding, John?
Well, John Ashcroft is very scientific, anti-scientific, I think, and very religious, and represents, in a fundamental way, the Enlightenment and our way of life is tied to the scientific view, and I think it's really unwise to equate that with the religious view because
John, we've got it, and I want to put that to Marcelo Gleiser as well. Marcelo Gleiser, do you think that in any sense, in acknowledging these shared questions, you're giving care and feeding to those who would turn back the clock and the frontier on the rational approach?
That is exactly what I'm not trying
mm-hmm.
to do. What I'm trying to do is precisely the opposite. What I'm trying to do is to open these people's eyes to science.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you can do that is by showing them what science has done. And they are not going to pick up a book that is written from, by a scientist that only mentions the science, let's put it that way. You have, it's like a bait, you have to approach people in the language they understand so they will respect your point of view.
It's powerful bait. I think the question that always comes up at this question, the issue of science and religion is there a frontier of understanding beyond which science cannot go? And then in the lay mind, does God or religion lie on the other side of that frontier? We may have a call relating to that. Let's turn to it. Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love the show. I am a Catholic who was educated at Boston College in metaphysics, Thomistic metaphysics,
okay.
and phenomenology.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we were always taught is that there are, you just segued into my question, that there are questions that science can't answer, like who or what created the core matter of the Big Bang, and what was it that it banged into? And I'm also wondering, in counter to the previous caller, can this be reconciled in a deist, a clockmaker philosophy that actually kind of was the core of the founders of our country that used that sort of
mm-hmm.
clockmaker,
mm-hmm.
wind it up, let it go type concept as a basis for reconciling science.
Jay, you've put a lot on the table there in a hurry, and thank you for both these questions. Marcelo Gleiser, I guess the first, and Jay raises it directly. Okay, there was a big bang. What banged, and what did it bang into?
So I think Jay's question was interesting because he was really saying that there are some things that are beyond the realm of science. And I think that's true. I don't think science was designed to answer everything. Science was not designed to be, the giver of all answers about all questions, that afflict us. In fact, in broad terms, you can always say, science deals with the relationship between man and cosmos, and religion deals with the relationship between man and man.
But what about his specific question then? Because this is exactly
right.
where a lot of people see the dividing line.
Right.
Okay,
so,
there's a big bang. What banged?
Very good. So what can we do about this question with the science that we have nowadays?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, we can provide you with a mathematical model, which is based on two big pillars of modern physics, which are called general relativity and quantum mechanics. And based on that, we can describe a way in which a universe can come out of basically a fluctuation of energy that was not there before. And that is perfectly acceptable and understood by physicists.
You mean the energy appeared out of nowhere and created the bang?
Yes. And that is because in this realm of quantum mechanics, which is realm of atoms and subatomic particles, energy is never exactly static. It can always fluctuate.
The religious mind would then say, well, God, whatever you imagine God to be, must have provided the energy.
No, you see, the beauty of it is that you don't need that. You can have a universe that has basically starts with absolute zero energy on average,
mm-hmm.
and it can have a local fluctuation which goes to positive energy, and that can just create the universe. And you don't need an external agent to do that. The same way you don't need an external agent to make a radioactive atom, a nucleus, you know, emit a particle, and which is basically radioactivity.
So then, further to Jay's question, you mean you don't need the clockmaker? You don't need the deist clockmaker, the god who was there, even if only at the beginning, to get this launched?
Yeah, there is only one problem with all this, mm-hmm. and I'm being completely honest here. And most people that
we expect no less.
Yeah, the most people that write books about this would agree with me, like Stephen Hawking and company, you know, mm-hmm. who actually work on this field. Mm-hmm. The point is that we cannot expect science to explain its own origins. And what happens here is that, you know, I said, you know, I can give you a mathematical model with certain laws, which are basically the laws of physics, you know, the conservation of energy and the two big theories, relativity and quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. the question then becomes, well, why is the universe this way and not a different way? You know, why is the universe mm-hmm. functioning right. under these laws? Where do these laws come from? Which is really at the core of the question, you know, which is, we cannot explain, science was not designed to explain its own origin.
Is that a scientific question then, or a religious question?
Well, it may become a scientific question in the future if science evolves, you know, and becomes something which it's not nowadays. Mm-hmm. Right now, what we can do, which I think is already spectacular, you know, and that's the whole point, and I think that's what John was trying to say, and I agree with him, is mm-hmm. that we have achieved a tremendous degree of sophistication in the way we understand the universe and the world around us. And that has been just because of the scientific method and the way we actually think about nature. And so we do understand the universe all the way very close to the beginning. We don't understand the beginning yet because we don't understand how to talk about, we don't know how to talk about that at this point. But that does not mean we will never be able to. It means we can't now.
Marcelo Gleiser, stand by for a minute. I want to bring a fellow scientist into the conversation to join us. Alan Guth is on the line. He's professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Good evening and welcome, Alan Guth.
Good evening, and hi, Marcelo.
Hi, Alan.
Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Guth. You, years ago, came up with the remarkable theory of inflation, the sort of super-fast early expansion of the universe immediately after the Big Bang. I guess the question that I would bring into the context of this conversation is, here you were doing postdoctoral research in particle physics in the 1970s at Cornell, and suddenly you find yourself focused on helping explain these vast cosmological questions. Is that what you set out to do? Or, as Marcelo Gleiser suggests, are we all drawn to these questions wherever we begin?
Well, I think we are drawn to these questions because they're so fascinating. But in this case, it very much is not what I was trying to do. I got involved in cosmology actually by being dragged into it by a friend of mine named Henry Tai. And he wasn't really interested in cosmology to begin with either. What we were focusing on were some new theories in particle physics, grand unified theories, and the question of what role magnetic monopoles would play in these theories. Mm-hmm. And when we decided that these magnetic monopoles were so heavy that you'd never be able to produce them in an accelerator, my friend Henry Tai immediately said, well, why don't we try to figure out how many of them would have been made in the Big Bang?
And suddenly there you were at the beginning of time. In the context of our conversation tonight, how do you understand the relative value of religion and science in human beings making sense of the universe? And are you always getting the same question, what lies just on the other side of scientific comprehension? Is it religion? Is it God?
Well, I guess I have to admit my attitudes are very similar to Marcelo for almost every question that's come up. I said, yeah, if I was there, I would have said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think at any given time, science has its limitations. And if we think about the origin of the universe itself, we certainly don't understand everything. But we can at least imagine a scientific theory that would explain how the universe would appear literally out of nothing, as Marcelo described. But that was still the question of where the laws of physics came from. And right now, I think it's fair to say that we really don't have a clue about how to answer that question. But I would also, I think, agree with Marcelo that even though we don't have a clue about how to answer that question now, it doesn't mean that it'll be the same if you come back in 10 years.
So do you see, in that sense, the aspects of religion that relate to cosmology as a kind of a holding pattern that helps us deal with the things we don't yet understand, or something more substantive?
Well, I think different people are certainly very much entitled to have their own opinions here, because certainly I don't know the answer to your question.
I guess we're interested in yours because you have, like Marcelo, have been right down there at the heart of the scientific matter.
Right. Well, I guess my hard to phrase my opinion, but basically I do not see any reason to believe in received wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I could tell, the observation of science are far more reliable than anybody's guess about what some deity has written down sometime in the deep past. But at the same time, the universe does seem to have behind it some kind of an underlying sense to it, underlying consistency, an underlying complexity, which I think we do not at all understand.
Mm-hmm.
And if one wants to have a religious attitude about that, I think there's certainly plenty of room for that. Although for myself, I sort of feel that somehow in the end, science will ultimately be able to explain all of this.
Marcelo Gleiser, here's your colleague in the sciences sharing, and we appreciate it, Alan Guth, sort of his intimate view of this core question. Is this what you typically find in the scientific mind focused on the cosmos?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the way I would say this is the following, is that once you decide to think about the universe in a rational way, you are learning to live with doubt. And that is a perfectly fine thing. And in fact, it's wonderful to be in doubt, because it's from ignorance that we get new knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is part of the scientific process for us not to know all the answers and always to be looking for answers. And that is the core distinction, I think, between a scientific mind and a religious mind. You know, the scientific mind will be in peace with that. And a religious mind, most, not all religious minds, but the most extreme ones at least, would say, I don't have any doubts because, you know, all knowledge comes from this divine revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And they make peace with their questions that way. And we think that science is a very exciting way of dealing with these doubts, and we like it. So I'm happy I don't know all the answers.
Alan Guth, we've just got 10 seconds before the break. Before we come to the end of time, are we going to understand what's going on?
I don't know.
There's a scientific answer. Alan Guth, professor of physics at MIT, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We're reading the cosmos tonight with Marcelo Gleiser and just joined by Alan Guth. We're trying to understand the beginning and end of the universe, and how science and religion have approached them, how they intertwine, or do they intertwine? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. How does scientific clarity on such vast questions change our view of the world? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're reading the cosmos tonight with Marcelo Gleiser. He's author of The Prophet and the Astronomer, A Scientific Journey to the End of Time, and a professor of philosophy, physics, and astronomy at Dartmouth College. We're looking at religion, science, and most of all, our understanding of the beginning and the end of the universe. Lauren's on the line. Welcome, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thank you.
Good. I actually just wanted to call and bring up a point and then kind of listen off the air to how it goes. But,
okay.
This is something that I've been thinking about when, you know, we talk about this topic, is just that when you consider religion in its relationship to science, you picture a God with a personality, or like, you know, someone you go to a church and worship, or that these traditions are based around, it's a God with a personality. And
you might, yes.
And when you start to go back to the idea of like a first cause, and it kind of gets reduced to an abstraction of just like a creative force, or, you know, basically a force that kind of created the universe, I think that you don't really get that God with a personality out of it. And I think that's where at least I find the biggest trouble trying to reconcile religion per se with, you know, the idea of a first cause or a force that created the universe.
Do you mean to say that the personality is important, is central to you?
Well, as far as the word religion goes, I'd say that the connotation to me anyway is a God with a personality. So I think that when you just try to go back to say, you know, what created the universe, and it becomes kind of a naturalistic, maybe it was just a force that set everything in motion, I think you kind of lose a sense of that personality or a loving creator or caring or a lot of the, you know, aspects that get ascribed to God from various religions.
Lauren, I think we can all relate to that. When you get to such vast concepts, certainly a God with a kind of human dimensionality becomes very hard to see in that context. Thank you for your call. Marcella Gleiser, we've talked a lot about the beginning tonight, but you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the end. Do we know when the cosmos will come to an end?
Well, to talk about the end, you have to go in stages, you know, because there are different kinds of ends. You can talk about the end of the Earth as a planet. You can talk about the end, or at least of life on Earth. You can talk about the end of the sun, our neighbor star here. And you can talk about the end of the cosmos as a whole.
Take us step by step.
Let's go step by step. Okay, so the Earth, what can happen here is what happened in the past. We have had several very cataclysmic collisions with asteroids and comets. You know, the most famous of them was 65 million years ago and is the one that obliterated the dinosaurs and about 40% of life on the planet. And
this hit near the Yucatan Peninsula.
Exactly. That's the one that had the impact crater is in the Yucatan Peninsula in the Gulf of Mexico.
This was an asteroid, about 10 kilometers wide, as I recall?
Yeah, about 6-7 miles wide, 10 kilometers or so, and coming down at 40,000 miles an hour. And just to give you an idea of what that, because people say, how can such a small rock create such a mass and in the whole world, you know? And to give an idea of the amount of energy that a collision like that is equivalent to, you would detonate all the hydrogen bombs that existed at the climax of the Cold War and multiply that power by 10,000.
You write that it sent dust and water halfway to the moon.
That's right. That's the estimate.
Our time is running down. We have to go step quickly ahead. The sun. So you're saying an asteroid could do it.
So basically, you know, it's very low probability. You know, nobody should go running naked down the street saying the world is going to end tomorrow. But these things do happen. And you even open your show talking about something that is happening
in 2019. That's not long from now.
Yeah, and these are the ones we see. You see, we don't see all of them, and that's the problem.
What are the odds then? If you're an odds maker, how far off is a brutal asteroid collision?
It's very small odds. You know, what would be more possible is to have something smaller happen that would basically destroy a city.
We've only got 1 minute left. Let's skip the sun and go straight to the end of it all.
Okay.
When and how?
Well, we don't know. The sun will be more interesting because the sun, we do know, the sun is going to blow up in about 5 billion years or so. And then, so I always joke, we have 5 billion years to get out of here.
Or for the Dow to get positive again.
And the universe itself, you know, most probably, although we can't say it for sure at this point, most probably it's going to expand forever and becomes colder and colder and the stars die and it's just going to be a cold death.
Expanding forever means a death of the universe in your mind, an extinction or a nothingness at some point?
Well, it depends how you define death, because death is a very anthropomorphic concept.
Of course, and which is I'm trying to morph here toward nothingness.
And what we have seen is the universe is a super dynamic place. You know, there's stars dying and being born all over the place at the same time. So, but if you could extrapolate to the future, yes, the universe would expand forever, and this other stars, just like our sun, would eventually run out of fuel. But we are talking billions and billions of years from now, and I don't think we have to be too worried about that at this point.
Marcella Gleiser, we won't worry about it at all, but we've loved this conversation tonight. I hope we can coax you back to do it again sometime.
Absolutely.
We've had far too short of infinite time to talk. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Marcella Gleiser is author of The Prophet and the Astronomer, A Scientific Journey to the End of Time. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, On Point movie maven Garen Daly sights his periscope on submarine movies. This is On Point.
You needlessly endangered this boat and its crew. 200 million Soviet citizens are depending on us, Captain Vostrikov, to save them from nuclear attack. You risked them as well.
I took this boat and these men to the edge because we need to know where it is. These 120 men are a crew now because they achieved something together that they did not think they could do. Next time, when it is not a drill, they will go to the edge and past it and die if necessary, because that is what their duty demands of them.
What you just heard is a clip from the new movie K-19. The film, starring Harrison Ford and Liam Neeson, is about the USSR's first nuclear submarine capable of throwing ballistic missiles, where Soviet sailors sacrificed themselves to prevent World War III. The film is co-produced by National Geographic and is being marketed as factually accurate. Whether it's dramatically successful is another question. The submarine has been the star of many movies throughout cinematic history. We're going down the hatch tonight to look at K-19 and its predecessors with Garen Daly, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. Good evening and welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
Was that Harrison Ford I heard with that mouthful of Russian accent?
And Liam Neeson. And I tell you, it's kind of unusual to see both of these actors putting on a Russian accent. It's a little disconcerting, to be honest about it.
It's like the President of the United States speaking Russian.
Yeah. And it's interesting that all of a sudden, for the first time, we are now looking at a Russian submarine, and it's out of the Cold War, and we're looking at them with kind of a fond eye. These were heroic young men who risked their lives, and many of them died, to prevent a nuclear war, based on a true story.
A true story, a story factual enough that National Geographic is involved in it. Why?
This is actually the second film that National Geographic has been involved in. What they're doing is they're developing stories, and this particular story came from a documentary they did about the incident, and they're selling it to Hollywood, and Hollywood's picking it up. There's no downside for National Geographic. It helps them get some notoriety and gives National Geographic the necessary exposure to be a vital magazine in America today.
But does it make a good film in the dark of the theater?
It makes an okay film. It's not as good as some of the films that I truly, truly loved as a young child watching these war movies, and even more recently, because to me, the absolute best submarine movie ever made is Wolfgang Petersen's Das Boot, which is a three-hour-plus epic. It's in German, and it has everything that you want in a submarine movie. It's about men, young men, old men, confined. And that's a real issue with submarines, the confinement of the environment, making it very, very difficult. And they're also very vulnerable. So at a moment's notice, they may be attacked by anything, and they have to do a crash dive.
...1981's Das Boot. Oh my gosh, everything's going to hell in a handbasket there. Hollywood keeps coming back to the submarine to make its movies.
It does. And it's been away since like 1910 when the very first submarine movie was made. It was called Aerial Submarine. And a lot of great directors have done films on submarines. Frank Capra did one in 1928. You've seen, you know, all the great heroes. Clark Gable did Run Silent, Run Deep. You know, all the big stars have been in submarine films. And it seems like every 4 or 5 years, another submarine film comes out.
Well, we remember Red October, Destination Tokyo. You're right. It's always there. Are more than 100 submarine films, I think, in total.
That's right. There's over 100 of them. And I think the reason is that directors like it because of that confined environment, because they're able to focus in on the relationships. The actors like it because they're able to have these kinds of relationships that are amazing and intense. And I think that screenwriters like it because they're able to explore the relationships. And in those relationships, we end up getting a lot of cliches because we've seen so many. And it's really rare that we see something fresh, new, and different coming out of a submarine movie.
Cliches, a lot of tight shots, and a lot of Germans.
A lot of Germans, yeah. It's interesting that, you know, these guys at one level are extremely vulnerable to the environment, to the interpersonal relationship, yet at the same time, they're incredibly lethal.
The Germans were for many years worldwide known as the submarine experts.
They were the submarine experts. Unfortunately, as the beginning of Das Boot points out, of the 40,000 submariners in World War II from Germany, 30,000 died.
Ooh, not a good assignment.
Not a good assignment at all. But, you know, one of the things that came out of all of this is that in 1957, Dick Powell, who was an actor, had his first crack at directing a film, and he did The Enemy Below, which is a wonderful film, one of my favorite submarine films. In the film, Robert Mitchum plays a destroyer captain. Kurt Jurgens plays a German submarine captain, and they're doing a cat-and-mouse dance in the ocean where each is trying to outthink the other. It's a big chess game. And interestingly enough, Kurt Jurgens, who is the German, comes across as just doing his job. There's no ideological Nazism going on with him at all. He is just doing his job. He's just trying to complete his mission, much the same that Robert Mitchum is trying to do the same thing as well.
Beats me how they get men to do it.
Do what?
Go and sit in that coffin down there.
Oh, they're not so bad off. Actually, they stand a better chance than we do in this case. Pretty hard for one ship to surprise them. Their commander might be able to knock us off if he's smart enough.
You think he is?
What, smart enough? We'll know that when it happens.
I wonder what sort of man he is.
I don't want to know the men I'm trying to destroy.
Cat and Mouse at Sea in 1957's The Enemy Below, and before the story's all over, the captain of the submarine and the captain of the destroyer are saluting one another, even as they're trying to destroy one another.
Both ships are destroyed at the end. They're both sinking. They've done this incredible cat and mousing, but there seems to be this honor among warriors. And it was very kind of uplifting in many ways.
It's only a couple of years since we had the last big-budget Hollywood film, U-571.
Yeah, U-571, which is a good film, factually inaccurate, and just chock full of every single cliche that you could possibly imagine in a Hollywood film. And one of the ones that I pulled out of this one was the fact that there always seems to be conflict between the captain and the XO, the executive officer. The XO is either, you know, trying to get the captain's job, or the XO is just not strong enough. And in this film, Matthew McConaughey has been passed over for command. And through quirks of circumstances, he is now in command of a submarine for the first time. And, of course, the grizzled Harvey Keitel, chief petty officer who's seen it all and done it all, is going to tell Matthew what he has to do to be a good captain.
Mr. Tyler, permission to speak freely.
Of course, Chief.
This is the Navy, where a commanding officer is a mighty and terrible thing. A man to be feared and respected. All-knowing. All-powerful. Don't you dare say what you said to the boys back there again. I don't know. Those three words will kill a crew. Dead as a depth charge. You're the skipper now. And the skipper always knows what to do, whether he does or not.
U-571 from just a couple of years ago, year 2000. Garen Daly, here we are. It's 2002. Germany, the Third Reich is history. The Soviet Union is history. The Cold War is over. Have submarine films just about come to the end of the line?
I don't think so. I think that there's going to be more and more submarine movies. Every couple of years, we'll find something new. We'll wrap a different plot around the same concept. And the basic concept is men in a confined space having to work together because one mistake means they go right to the bottom of the sea and they die.
You call it, then. What's the next story that's going to turn into a submarine film?
I don't know, but I think I want to hit you with one of my trivia questions, though.
Okay.
All right. In K-19, there's a fact that makes it a first. Do you know what that is?
A first. Harrison Ford says, Das Svidaniya.
No, that's actually pretty good, but no. It's the first submarine film directed by a woman, Catherine Bigelow.
And does the woman succeed?
She does. Catherine Bigelow is a very, very good director. She's a good action director. She's only one of the few women out there who does action really, really well.
Well, this time a woman goes underwater with a whole lot of men in K-19. Garen Daly, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
We all live in a yellow submarine. Yellow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Yellow submarine. We all
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our